This is Classic Rain number 29, posted November 28, 2020. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Those of us who are now retired, including Rain founder Hap Holly, KC9RP, are experiencing what longevity means, i.e. seeing our friends in and out of ham radio becoming silent keys. One such friend and mentor who passed this fall was Ken Piletic, W9ZMR. Ken was well known in the greater Chicago area for faithfully maintaining the Midwestern phone line for decades for the amateur radio newsline phone service as far back as the early 80s, when it was known as Westlink Radio. Ken was the driving force behind ORCATS, the old-time radio collectors and traders society that brought old-time radio collectors together Sunday mornings on 40 meters, 7238 kilohertz. We're going to excerpt from several audio contributions Ken voiced for the Rain Report and earlier. This first excerpt is a serious commentary he provided the Rain Report in 1994 on what became known then as slow code.
This is Ken, W9ZMR. I don't usually get on soapboxes much, but the subject of slow code prompts me to climb up here. For those readers who are not familiar with slow code, it is a lobby to lower the 13-word-per-minute Morse code exam to 10 words per minute. The slow code movement is based on the false idea that it will open up new technology on the ham bands by allowing HF access to highly technical hams who are not interested in CW, but will bring innovative ideas into the amateur radio service. In fact, the new technology is being implemented on the higher frequencies, where no-code hams are already qualified to operate. The slow-code idea is advocated by manufacturers, importers, and dealers, whose only interest in ham radio is money-related. These promoters have no interest whatever in technology or public service. The only thing they want is more people to buy their equipment. Please don't be fooled by their tactics. Remember, when you lower the standards, you get substandard results. Climbing off the soapbox now, this is Ken, W9ZMR.
We'll take you back to 1988 for a fun piece of amateur radio history that will answer the question.
Did you ever wonder why Hamfest tickets are usually long and narrow?
This is Ken, W9ZMR. Did you ever wonder why Hamfest tickets are usually long and narrow? Some tickets even have a quarter-inch hole punched in one end. Do you know why? Well, if you've been a ham for 30 years or more, you probably do. But for those of you who don't, this may be interesting information. Once upon a time, long, long ago, all hams operated CW only. These hams were known only by their call sign, and some could be identified by the sound of the spark or the swing of the individual fist. When these hams met for the first time at a ham fest, they could not recognize each other by their visual appearance or by the sound of their voices. Each ham had a little tag on which was written his call sign. This tag was attached to a button on his coat or shirt. Now, everybody at the fest could be recognized. Ham fest tickets were designed so that the call sign could be written on them vertically, so they wouldn't turn upside down if they were suspended from the top. A hole was punched to allow for a string. Tie the string to the ticket, tie the other end of the string to a shirt button. When hams began operating phone, it became easier to use names or handles in casual QSOs. So hams wrote their names as well as their call signs on the Hamfest tickets. Hams continued to wear the tickets attached to their buttons until the mid-1950s. When the engraved laminated badge appeared. Badge engravers did a land office business at ham fests as hams by the hundreds lined up to get a personalized badge. The badges were worn, the tickets were left in their pockets. You probably remember about 5 years ago when baseball caps and hats with iron-on call signs were sold at ham fests. Now everybody had either a badge or a cap. Some people had both. Nobody wore his ticket. So, what's the purpose of this little story? Why mention it now? There seems to be a trend towards hams remaining incognito at hamfests. I don't know why, but more and more hams are not wearing any kind of identification. With the 1987 Hamfest season just beginning, I believe this is the right time to reverse this trend. The Bear is a relatively new repeater. There are a lot of voices I recognize on the air, and there are a lot of call signs that are becoming familiar. But how many would be recognized at a Hamfest? I would like to see every ham wear some kind of badge or tag so we can recognize each other and have eyeball QSOs. Speaking for myself, I know I missed two Bear members at the Wheaton Hamfest, and I was looking for them. You don't have to go out and buy a badge or a cap. Just get out your crayon and print your call sign on your Hamfest ticket. Then tie the ticket to your button. Hey, here's a suggestion for a survey question. Do you wear a call sign identifier at Hamfests? Yes or no? Yes, I do. And I'm Ken, W9ZMR, for the Bear Information Service.
We'll continue our tribute to the late Ken Piletic, W9ZMR, in a moment. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
Welcome back to our tribute to longtime ham radio good guy Ken Piletic, W9ZMR. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Ken spent a number of years recording and collecting old-time radio shows. The following is an excerpt from an RP Report interview with Ken, conducted by Steve Bauer, KC0HF, in 1988.
When I started collecting old-time radio programs, they weren't old-time, they were current radio programs, and I didn't realize there was really anything to it. I had a tape recorder in 1948, if you can believe that. Most people in 48 were working with wire recorders or home disc recorders. But somewhere along the line, my dad came home with a tape recorder. It did not belong to him. It belonged to someone else. And eventually, he got it. I don't know if he bought it from them or if he inherited it or what, but he wound up with it. And then eventually, I wound up with it. And it used paper tape. If you remember back years ago, magnetic tape had a paper backing. And I only had two tapes. And they were both 5-inch reels. The machine ran at only 7.5 IPS, so that's 15 minutes. And then I'd put the other tape on, run it for 15 minutes, and then I'd erase them both. And I was doing like most people do. You talk into the microphone, record various things. And one day I discovered you could tap into the radio with alligator clips. Clip right onto the loudspeaker and plug it in to the tape recorder and record directly off the air and get a halfway decent recording. So I did that. I recorded a lot of programs off the air, played them back and erased them, recorded something else and play them back and erase them, and did that for a number of years. And then after that, I found that I could get more tape, so started playing around with tape. Recording broadcast radio, network shows from different places like Jack Benny, that was one of the big ones, and some of the other comedy shows. Our Miss Brooks did a lot of those right at the very beginning, and some mystery programs. I didn't record any Inner Sanctums live at that point. Did a lot of suspense, escape. X-1 was coming on the air. That was about 1955 at that point in time, and I started collecting the X-1 science fiction stories. I kept recording a lot of these kind of things, and at the same time, my ham career was coming along, and I was going to school, and all this stuff all happens at the same time. Finally, in 1957, everything just kind of went on hold. All the tapes went up on the shelf, and I went off to learn electronics, went to the big city of Chicago. 2 years later, from that, I interviewed with IBM, and I hired on with IBM, which is where I'm still working today. And as my career developed in business and all of that, I didn't do a whole lot until about 1969. In 1969, I saw an ad in a newspaper or magazine or somewhere. The guy says, for sale, old-time radio programs on tape. And I said, well, that's kind of strange that somebody would be selling something like that. So I called him up on the phone. And I was really amazed that he had a collection. He had been doing pretty much the same thing that I was doing, is collecting things off the air as the programs were broadcast. And by 1969, there was, for all practical purposes, no radio left. There was no such a thing as broadcast radio. Everything was disc jockeys and a lot of sports and stuff. But there was no drama, no mystery, no comedy. Anyhow, I called this guy up, and it turns out that he was supporting himself going to school with this hobby of selling old-time radio programs. And we got to talking, and he says, well, he said, send me a copy of your catalog. And I said, well, I don't have a catalog. And and he said, well, we should have a catalog. Tell me what you got, and I'll send you my catalog. So I did. I made up a little catalog, and I sent it to him and got his. And we found that, respectively, we had different programs than each other did, because we were both doing the same thing, recording them off the air. He had some other sources, which I don't know where they were, but he had some other sources of material that I had. The only thing I had was what I had recorded.
By swapping old-time radio programs with people across the country and continuing to record more, Ken's collection of old-time radio continued to grow over the next few years.
This is 1988. I have approximately 43,000 programs. And these particular programs, I collect anything that I don't have. I'm not fussy. Some people only want comedy. Some people only want performances like the Bing Crosby Show and things like that. But I'll take anything I don't have. And in a lot of cases, I trade for things that I do have because we might get a better quality show.
In 1971, an informal group of hams were meeting on the air on Sunday mornings, and they all found that they had a joint interest, old-time radio. And in a matter of weeks, the Old Time Radio Collectors and Traders Society was formed.
Larry and I were talking every Sunday morning, and we were the starters of the ORCATS, the Old Time Radio Collectors and Traders Society. We didn't call ourselves then at that time, but we just got on 40 meters, and at that time we were on 7248. And we're talking about old-time radio, and it was just the two of us. And then one day, one other fella came in. I think it was Belvin, WBADSL. Larry was in Ohio. Belvin was in Michigan. I was in Illinois. But anyway, we were three of us talking in there. And we'd trade a couple of tapes, and it was just the three of us for a long, long time. Well, then the FCC decided to change the band around a little bit, and suddenly the frequency that we had been using was open up to general class licensees. And all at once, here is a whole raft of people who had been listening to us every every Sunday morning. We had an audience. We didn't know it. These guys all had general class licenses. They could not operate in that frequency. Well, all of a sudden now the FCC changed the rules. Larry and I were on there, and all of a sudden we had breakers all over the place, and that was the beginning of our larger organization. A lot of people came in, a lot of people left, and about 1975, we pretty well formalized ourselves into an organization which we called the ORCATS. We finally had to come up with a name, so we called ourselves the Old Time Radio Collectors and Traders Society. And we did change frequency also. We went from 7248 to 7238. That's because there was some kind of a net on 7250 that we were bothering them and they were bothering us. So we decided it would be better if we moved. We didn't have very many people at that time, so we just moved down 10KC to 7238.
We'll wrap up this tribute to Ken with the last piece of audio from Ken we could find. It's a short, humorous piece called Wear Your Stinking Badge. He wrote and produced it for the Rain Report in 1994.
Hi, gang. This is Ken, W9ZMR. An often misquoted line is, badges? We don't need any stinking badges. Well, we do need our stinking badges at Hamfests. Some of us who have been on the air 40 or more years have trouble putting together call signs, names, and faces. Some of the newer hams have yet to meet eyeball to eyeball, and the badges do help with that first-time eyeball QSO. So please, wear your badge at Hamfest. A badge doesn't have to be of laminated plastic or embroidery. A simple piece of paper with your call sign and name will suffice. Now for the correct quotation. In the 1948 motion picture, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Humphrey Bogart asks,
if you're the police, where are your badges?
And Alfonso Bedoya replies with these famous lines.
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges.
I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
And I'll see you at the next Hamfest. I'll be wearing my stinking badge. This is Ken, W9ZMR.
And this concludes our tribute to the late Ken Piletic, W9ZMR. Ken Piletic, audio courtesy of Hapali, KC9RP's Ham Radio Archive. Ken became a Silent Key September 3rd, 2020. Though he's now a Silent Key, those who knew him learned a great deal about audio from him. He was someone you should have known. The Classic Rain Hamcast is copyright 1987-2020 Rain. All rights reserved. Classic Rain Hamcast number 30 is scheduled to post December 12 on therainreport.com. Now for Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. In the meantime, don't forget the three W's. Keep on hamming.